But I also want to mention behind me, and we'll be taking the presentation in just a little bit, is Stephanie Wood. My name is Andres. I work with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. And Stephanie works with the Harm Reduction Action Center. But today we are both here as representatives of the Injection Drug Use Community Collaborative. So the IDU Community Collaborative is made up of not just representatives from the state health department here in Colorado, but also some of the local health departments and also some community-based organizations that serve the IDU population. So here's our learning objectives for today. Okay, we're going to be looking at health service utilization characteristics, behaviors, and also barriers. And we know there's a lot of barriers when it comes to injection drug users. We're also going to look at perspectives and experiences of the healthcare professionals and their IDU patients. And we're going to identify and evaluate some client-centered care. So our methodology for this, we looked focused on the last 10 years, we're looking for data that was based here in Denver. Now, one of the things that we found is when we're looking at published articles and material, there really was not a lot available, unfortunately. And so what we had to do is we went ahead and looked at some things that were not yet published but in process, and we also were able to get some data from some of the community-based organizations that work directly with IDUs. Very quickly, you'll see the little note at the bottom there that the presentation today is not going to distinguish differences in substance, gender, race, ethnicity, or length of use. And the reason for that, again, is there just was not a lot of data to use. Does anybody know what those are? Cookers? Yeah? Okay, good. Yeah. All right, good. Peter knows. Okay. So when we're talking about injection drug use, there's some universal drug users, there's some universal health disparities that occur, right? IDUs are among the most stigmatized of populations. They have disproportionately high morbidity and mortality from injection-related conditions, but the health disparities that we see are very, very similar to other marginalized populations. So here in Denver, the Denver Office of Drug Strategy estimates that there's just under 5,000 injection drug users in the Denver metro area. Many people in the field believe that that is quite a bit underestimated. Really quickly, just because you'll see these again, this is some of the different studies that we used for our data. So starting from the left, we have the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. We have the Center for Disease Control along with Denver Public Health. And that was the National HIV Behavioral Surveillance Study that was done. And we also have a study by Jessica Coring and Stephanie Wood and Jeremy Long, and that was factors related to quality healthcare services with IDUs. And another one that we found was Christina Phillips and Mark Stein, and that was risk practices associated with bacterial infections among IDUs. So this is where we basically are pulling the information that we're presenting today. Really quickly, some of the injection-related conditions that we saw were HIV, hepatitis C, IV-related hospital visits, and then also there's also big issues with overdose and abscess. As you can see, the numbers here are very high. Three or more overdoses in the last, I believe it was 6 months. It's very high. So what are some of the mediating factors to quality care when it comes to IDUs? Well, this is a pretty basic list, right? Ability to pay, being able to be close to where you're getting served, human and service needs. Okay, so IDUs are very complex. They're going to need a lot of times help, not just with their medical care, but also things like housing, employment, a lot of the basic things that other patients may or may not have to deal with. One of the things you'll notice when you're looking at this list of mediating factors is a lot of these are very similar to other at-risk populations, right? The last three are actually mediating factors on the other side, as far as these mediating factors really relate to the healthcare provider or the system itself. Here's some socio-demographic information. You see that there's a low level of education among injection drug users, very low income. That leads to a lack of permanent housing for a lot of folks, and also a very high rate of incarceration. You see here it's almost 50% were incarcerated at some point in the last 12 months. So all that's really going to come into play when it comes to accessing some of this healthcare. And now Stephanie is going to discuss how these characteristics affect healthcare utilization.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm Stephanie Wood. I work with the Harm Reduction Action Center. And as Andreas said, we are ambassadors today of several agencies that are part of the IDU Community Collaborative. That's why we chose to present together. This is not only our own data, although some of my own data is in here with Jessica Coring and Jeremy Long from the School of Medicine LEADS program here in Denver. So I'm just going to summarize some different aspects of the healthcare experiences among injection drug users, as well as some of the preliminary research being done around patient or the provider perspective on the IDU patient. So a few of the things that you're going to see here, and again, this isn't uncommon among other populations experiencing health disparities, approximately half have no coverage whatsoever of any type of services. And then the Colorado Indigent Care Program, which is a state local coverage program, it's per county, and Denver Health is the primary provider for CICP here in town. Stout Street Clinic is also another through the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless. So individuals are typically going through Denver Health, but they're also going through Stout Street Clinic as well. Also, I think something else important, at least among the cohort that was done here with this project, approximately two-thirds were homeless, and you know the Veterans Administration had put out a report that said 1 in 4 homeless individuals are veterans. And yet if you look at the numbers here, it's 2.8 are actually accessing veteran administrative services. One possibility for that reason is that they're actually splitting up care, so they might get emergency care and some of those other sort of general conditions addressed through the CICP program at Denver Health, and then they are going to the VA hospital for other services. So there might be a split in care services there. So the determinants of accessing care, you know, why have you gone to the, you know, to your medical site for the last 12 months? These aren't uncommon, are they? You recognize the convenience of location, care coverage. These are obviously huge factors to determine why a person would choose the place that they do. Health condition in that situation coming up immediately is not only IV use, IV associated, such as an abscess or overdose, but it's also for other conditions such as asthma, some other or diabetes, especially among aging injection drug users. Also, I just want to mention the no choice really tends to relate to the a situation where a person may have experienced an overdose, is in some sort of an emergency care situation where the ambulance is taking them to the nearest hospital rather than where they prefer to go to. So IDU care experiences, again, we're using IDU to describe injection drug users. This is some new data. We've actually just put this out really recently. It is going to take more work. But it's interesting that approximately 65% have said that healthcare workers did indeed take time to talk to them about their health problems. And then also another high, you know, approximately 60-65% of health workers took the time to listen. So on some level, even though in the big picture we want 100%, right, or at least in the 90s, but we don't want to completely dismiss the hard work that is going on among providers here in town. I think that as you increase health communication and health literacy, those numbers have an opportunity to go up as well. However, you're going to see quite a lower number on the healthcare workers made me feel that it was safe to explain my drug use. So what you might be finding is that the numbers for the first two, if the person hasn't disclosed their drug use, then that number might be a little higher. But if you cross-reference for, you know, if a person actually had reported it, that those numbers might in fact go down. So, again, you're going to see, you see that there are different types of data being reflected here. As the IDU community collaborative ambassadors, we're calling ourselves, we really did want to get as much input that we could from different sources. So the Harm Reduction Action Center, which is where I work, we actually provided an opportunity for individuals to provide testimonials, you know, testimonial descriptions on their healthcare experiences. Approximately 120 have participated in this so far. And it's not, you know, real usable data, but it's a way that CBOs do have the opportunity to contribute their hard work and their experience with their population. So we always want to encourage that wherever possible. Some of these are standards. Again, they're not so unusual. The top one really has to do with navigation. Here a person's told that they have a chronic condition, and yet they have no idea how to actually navigate through the system to access a primary care provider. Didn't ask my health questions. Again, that low sense of self-efficacy. Again, communication can be a piece of that. IDU-specific needs for care are particularly important. One of the reasons that individuals won't access care is because they feel that they're not being listened to. It's a very painful process for phlebotomists to try to access, you know, veins, even though the IDUs typically know which veins are best to access, correct? But that can be a real problem where that competency piece is not coming in. Suicide watch, there's a whole situation around maybe symptoms not being taken seriously or the need to medically stabilize individuals before they can actually provide higher services. However, the perception of the patient, you know, they don't quite understand those processes. And then again, the ongoing challenge for providers to recognize the difference between drug-seeking behavior and actual, the need for pain management. So I'm going to just run through these a little bit more quickly here. Again, other aspects of the attitudes is that we can again see that there is a need for patients to feel that their providers are taking an interest in their life situation. Again, as some other folks have described, that injection drug users are tend to be quite complex in their needs. And so the opportunity to connect to resources, have those moments where you actually can do more than just put the Band-Aid on the situation is very useful. Let's see. So this is, to me, this is very similar to the other things that I described, that if an individual doesn't feel safe to be able to disclose their injection drug use, if they fear stigma, and which they often do, especially with historical discrimination, then they tend to be less comfortable and that rapport isn't established. So real quickly here, again, through those testimonials, these are standard, aren't they? I know Andreas and I were discussing this before. We've both been through a situation where we received poor, you know, fair to poor care and we immediately transferred providers. These situations are not so unique. What is very difficult to understand is where issues are really IDU, where discrimination is really happening versus, you know, the actual quality of care the organization might be struggling with themselves. And that's something that really needs to be teased out in future studies. Last piece here is about the care provider perceptions. This was actually done during competency trainings with three different hospitals, St. Joe's, Denver Health, and St. Anthony's. And it's interesting because a large percentage were unable to describe what harm reduction is as a concept, which is really principles of providing professional care, you know, and understanding that you need to meet individuals where they're at to be able to establish a rapport and to move forward to where you can actually succeed in providing them with the services that they need. Interestingly enough, what do you think about this? That 80% have reported that they've never personally discriminated in service, yet 73% have witnessed peer discrimination. And of course, I think a piece of this has to do with the definition of discrimination, right? You know, there are some extreme stories that patients will tell you about how, you know, just some really, really awful, awful experiences. And yet, discrimination can be much more subtle, correct? You can imagine in other populations, marginalized populations you've worked with. So I thought that was quite interesting. And then also, again, and this is an area I'm particularly interested in, looking at down the road in other research, is that the frustration may not be IDU specific. What can happen is you have providers that are already overtaxed, they're already overwhelmed, especially in the emergency departments. They're already dealing with very complex patients, then they feel frustrated to be able to actually provide good quality service to these to their patients sitting in front of them. And one of those issues is not knowing where to send people to, not knowing how to be able to connect these individuals to other resources. So, strained providers, complex needs patients, and then the perception of stigma that injection drug users tend to be prone to. Again, the care complaints may not be specific to IDUs. You know, anyone that's spent any quality time in the emergency room, you can easily feel frustrated, right? There's natural organizational challenges that agencies have to provide good medical services. But IDUs tend to feel personally targeted because of that historical discrimination piece, as well as some other social marginalization, you know, issues that come up. Provider frustration, again, may not be IDU specific, and again, the IDUs may not distinguish their reasons for provider frustration. And organizational support and competency trainings for providers really, really can be useful. Support from the employee assistance programs are very helpful, as well as CBOs like the Harm Reduction Action Center, actually going out into those agencies and, you know, educating, providing competency, and also just providing emotional support can be very, very useful. On the other end, it's also very helpful for CBOs to actually work with injection drug users directly, right? In order to really bridge the gap, you want to come from both ends. So working out, teaching skills in health literacy and communication and, you know, working out those types of things provide great opportunities for people to meet in the middle. And the last thing I was going to mention is the importance, again, of the primary care medical home model, the PCMH model. You know, they've made some great recommendations on how to reach out to these marginalized populations. And there's plenty of opportunities in Denver or wherever, whatever cities you're coming from personally. An example would be syringe exchange programs, which have been very successful in Baltimore, New York, some other places that have really been able to connect IDUs to good care. Here in the past, we had the Stout Street Clinic, I mentioned, was part of Colorado Coalition for the Homeless. They used to actually it was a mobile clinic. Malia Davis, great example. She had amazing relationships with injection drug users. And because you're really meeting people where they're at, you know, literally in some cases. So there are some great opportunities to provide a medical home outside of the standard. Thank you. So last thing is I just wanted to acknowledge all the individuals that participated in this process and also the NHBS data that Denver Public Health and CDC will be doing. There's a list right there of when they're going to be presenting tomorrow on Hep C seroprevalence and some other areas. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Okay, now we can open the session up for questions.
Yes.
Ask our respondents to
A, determine the level, the different sources of care that they received. So that was one indication. Like some people, you know, only used emergency rooms because they didn't have insurance or whatever. Like I said, other people had private doctors. So there was a breakdown in that sense. And then some of the questions might have been more specific to obviously like administrators are not the ones who were, you know, physically, you know, doing the examinations to certain patients. So there's some way to distinguish, but there wasn't specific questions that asked about the different roles of healthcare providers.
And that's a great question for us too, because the definition of provider is very complicated, again, among populations, especially that lack health insurance and lack that patient-provider relationship. In our case, it really depended per study. At times we use the term healthcare worker. And also I wanted to mention that when we looked at provider perspective, that was actually very, very rarely primary care providers. They're extremely hard to catch, you know, and this is actually the next level of research that I'd like to look into with Andreas, possibly, if he's game. Really trying to really sit down with that specific population, especially ED versus some other environments, and really try to tease out what those factors are and what it is that they need from support.
Zahara, he has a question.
I was just wondering, how were the LGBTs identified at the point of care?
Well, again, through the questionnaire, people were able to self-identify. So people, you know, in the survey identified as lesbian, gay, bisexual, queer, trans, same gender loving, you know, the different assortment of identities. And we used the major five categories that I just mentioned. And then also, what was your question? I'm sorry.
I mean, at the point of care, how did the provider identify this?
Well, that's kind of, it's not entirely clear because, you know, like I said, there were questions that asked how they identified. There were questions that asked, you know, what kind of services they were feeling discriminated against or barriers to, and then the kinds of sources of their care. So there weren't specific questions that distinguished, you know, whether they were getting care at, you know, for one specific issue. I mean, for some of them, like the transgender patients, there were specific questions about surgery and, you know, issues, healthcare issues specific to trans, but it was really just looking at a kind of a broader experience overall.
Okay. And the population, was it LGBTs with HIV or LGBTs and HIV?
It was LGBT people and people with HIV. Now, so there were some overlaps, so maybe there were, you know, gay men with HIV or trans men with HIV. There were also straight people with HIV who were included in the data as well.
Okay.